live from the EAA Air Show in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. This is the Bob Davis Podcasts, Podcast 529. Yeah, I'm right under the tower where I am always parked. So far, this is my second year at EAA. And I always celebrate on Sunday nights with a podcast that isn't necessarily about the air show, although I will talk about the air show. I've been here. I got in from, I blew out of Cleveland, red-balled it to Southern Illinois to see my friend Steve on the farm there, and then came over here, I guess Friday, I think I left Friday night, and I hung out in Racine on Friday night, Saturday morning, and then I got up early because of the heat. You don't, unless you've got the diesel on all night, which I don't want to do with the AC in mobile podcast command, then, you know, you're pretty much up as soon as the sun comes up because this thing gets heated up pretty quick. So I'm kind of on a day schedule. I'm kind of tired and confused because of that, but I'm having a good time. I got here Saturday about 11 o'clock and got loaded in. And, you know, the show is open that weekend, although there's no show. The show doesn't start until tomorrow morning. But everybody's coming in and setting up. You see the show come together, and you watch people building things and everything else. And I am parked right under the tower across the little road from where they are giving away the Piper Cub this year. It's an old Army Piper Cub, which has been completely rebuilt. And so that guy will be rolling tomorrow. And it's a continuous loop tape of some old guy talking about how great it would be to win this plane. So I'm here at the air show for Alpha Systems, and I'll talk about that in a little while. So I'm sitting here, and I get a call from my friend Bob at Hydrus. And he says, "Where are you?" And I go, "I'm up at the air show." And he lives in Chicago. And he goes, "I'm coming up with a bunch of Hydrus. Can you get your friends at Alpha Systems to hand it out at the booth?" And I said, "Sure, I'll ask them if they want to do that." So I look up a couple of hours later. Now remember, I'm here in Oshkosh, and I'm sitting in my truck, and I look out the window, and here comes Bob, who's kind of he's a businessman type guy, and he's kind of very light skinned German guy from Iowa, and he's carrying this giant box of Hydrus. I couldn't believe it. And I had just gone over. Mark Korn and the guys were setting up the Alpha Systems booth, and they were just covered in sweat. And so I went over, because Mark drinks a sports drink, which I will not identify at this time, but it has sugar in it. And I went over there, and I said, "I'm going to go mix you up some Hydrus, because you dilute a little bit of Hydrus in a 16.2-ounce container of water, and then you drink it." And I took it over there, and I gave it to him, and he sucked that bottle down like a baby. And shortly thereafter, I get the call, and I see Bob coming with the Hydrus. So if you are doing any kind of sports, CrossFit, yoga, whatever, it will transform your practice. I've talked about that. But if you're doing something like this here today where people are setting up, they're sweating, it's really hot, the dew point was like 80 and the temperature was 95, it was insufferable out here, bright sunshine all day long. If you're out on the flight line, if you're, you know, riding around helping people set up tents and things like that at some festival that you're doing this summer, some art fair or the state fair or something like that, this is where Hydrus can come in for you, because you're fully hydrated. You're gonna be able to handle things a little bit better. And here's what happens when you get dehydrated. And I noticed this. I got real tired, and I just want, you know how it is when you're out in the sun and it's real hot? I was real tired, and I was just like, I need to go take a nap. And then I thought, you know what? I'm dehydrated. That's my problem. So I drank a Hydrus. I did take a little bit of a nap, but it didn't last long because I looked up and there was Bob. So don't forget. And here's what you do if you want to find out about Hydrus. You click on the Hydrus banner at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page. That will take you to their page, HydrusPerformance.com, H-Y-D-R-U-S, HydrusPerformance.com. It gets electrolytes into your muscles really fast. And it doesn't use sugar to do it. It uses something called nanosome technology to get the electrolytes into your system, and it works really fast and really well. I could tell you all kinds of yoga stories, but I won't. But I'm taking that entire box over there for the folks at Alpha Systems tomorrow, because Building C, which is where Alpha Systems is at the EAA, I kept saying they're in Building 3. I don't know what I was thinking there. And Building C is hot because it's not air conditioned. It's just got blown air. It's forced air through there. And it's nice, but it is humid and hot inside buildings. In fact, all these hangars are humid and hot until this hot weather clears. So don't forget, HydrusPerformance.com, H-Y-D-R-U-S, HydrusPerformance.com. Directly across from where I'm parked is the beginning of the media pavilion. Aero News is right across from me, and then there's some RVs behind me. And on the other side are the air traffic controllers, who are super intense, and I love them. They're really fun to be near because they know how to party. They party. So I've been here for a couple of days, and this is such a great event because it's, I don't want to say it's an apolitical event, because of course everyone has opinions, but you don't hear anything. You don't hear people discussing politics. As I talked about last year, they talk about their planes and they talk about their journey yesterday and today. If you sat out on the flight line, it was just one plane after another coming in. And then those people taxi over to one of the airfields, and then they pitch their tents under their planes. And we had a big storm here last night, something fierce, and it rained pretty much all day. The dew points are really high. It is now about 10:30. I'm sitting out here, and you can sort of hear the low hum of the show. It's pretty much shut down at this point, with people, the occasional people driving by, and security and whatever, but that's pretty much it. So it's good to be here. I'm looking forward to doing a full week of podcasts from this location and just chilling out. I took a shower today at the Shower Pavilion, which is pretty cool. It takes a couple years if you come to this, and if you want to stay here, you can camp here without a plane. They've got campgrounds. It's great for kids, and if you like to camp, you know, you're camping with a bunch of people, and some of the campgrounds are really nice, so it's a cool... That's one of the really cool things about the EAA. And then, of course, aviation is just exciting. First of all, there's the natural pull of being able to fly a plane, which is pretty cool in itself. And, you know, I'm too old in the sense that I'm afraid that I would kill myself or I would go get my pilot's license, because I think one of the coolest things, I'd love to be able to fully relate to people here who are pilots and in their experiences, and talk to them about their experiences by flying in here. One of my clients, I won't say who, is a pilot, and he was telling me a great story about how for his first job, he was hired right out of college to ferry Beechcraft. I mean, he's an airline pilot now, to ferry Beechcraft, brand new Beechcraft to twin engine executive planes from wherever they were to this location, so they could sell them or display them or whatever. And he said, we were talking about air traffic controllers in the air show and everything else. In fact, he may be here at some point. He said, so I had never encountered anything like this show in terms of traffic density until I came here during the show. And, you know, you understand, I'm a college kid, basically. I'm flying a brand new, at the time, state-of-the-art twin-engine aircraft. And the tower doesn't really tell you much. They just say, Beechcraft, you know, watch out for traffic to the east and land on the numbers, or whatever it is that they say. And I will tape some more of the tower, because the EAA tower is something to behold, even as I sit under it. I worship the EAA tower. But Dave said that he sweated through his shirt, basically. He said, I was really white-knuckling it, trying to figure, you know, because I'd never encountered that kind of traffic. And I think we were talking about it in relation to O'Hare and the traffic controllers at O'Hare and stuff like that, because my friend Mitch, who is a pilot, and I sit around the deck and listen to air traffic control and watch the planes and stuff. So we get into these conversations about air traffic controllers and what they say and do. And of course, Dave had all kinds of opinions about that. But anyway, hopefully he'll be here. Maybe I can get him on to talk about that kind of stuff at some point. It's a little windy out here. I really wanted to be outside for this podcast, and I'm using the studio mics, which are very sensitive to wind, but I'm on the lee side. First, I just feel like I should explain that, you know, the vehicle has lots of options for recording live outside. I can put the mics out the back. I figured out tonight I can move the whole kit and caboodle to the side and open up the other side. There's a medicine cabinet, and I can put all the equipment in the medicine cabinet and put the mics directly outside. And then I can operate the controls and stuff while I'm doing it. Then there's another side that comes in through where the oxygen tank used to be. And there's a little window inside the vehicle where I can run the cables. Well, it's so windy now. You can hear probably in the distance the flagpoles and the grommets banging on the flagpole. I just had a gigantic steak dinner, so that's part of the problem that, you know, I'm afraid I don't want to start burping or hiccuping because I just had a huge steak. But anyway, so I had to come over to this side, to the side with the little window where the oxygen tanks used to be, and then open the door to break the wind a little bit. So the dew points are down. The temperature is very pleasant. The moon is out. We're getting some clouds, a little bit of clouds, but basically the heat of the day has dissipated, and it's very, very nice out here, very pleasant out here. So in this podcast, you know, I don't want to destroy the mood by talking politics, but a lot has happened since the Republican convention, and I spent the day first. I'll tell you what happened. I have a gentleman who sends me funny jokes and memes, and generally they have nothing to do with politics. They're just funny jokes about the, you know, the guy who goes to the doctor's office, blah, 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 blah. And today he sent me an email that said, Donald Trump's going to bring all the jobs back to the United States. You need to vote for Trump. And there were some other things put in there about how Trump's not an establishment candidate and he's the anti-establishment. There's only one party for the elites, and that's the Democratic Republican Party, which I don't know what that meant. And so I started thinking about that, and I thought about it. I thought about this whole Trump thing all day. Now, I mentioned in a previous podcast the amount of, you know, the degree of division within the Democratic Party. And today, with the resignation of Debbie Wasserman Schultz from the DNC chairmanship position, you can see now how these divisions are starting to play out in the Democratic Party. And they're just as strong in the Democratic Party as they are in the Republican Party. The WikiLeaks thing, Julian Assange has released some 25,000 DNC emails, which clearly show, reportedly that the Democrats have been doing everything they can do to stop Bernie Sanders. And, you know, he also says that there's another tranche of emails coming out that will clearly result in the indictment of Hillary Clinton. So we'll have to see about that. The last story that I saw today was that the Democrats are moving to change the rules the same way the Republicans did, to basically institutionalize the superdelegates and prevent grassroots movements. And Bernie Sanders seems to have laid down. And even though he's made some comments, he still hasn't broken with the Democratic Party, and he still hasn't refused to endorse Hillary Clinton. It will be interesting to see if he does. So there's that. And I don't want the Democrats to get short shrift. I think there's going to be more protests in Philadelphia, as my friend Mike Opelka suggested. We'll see. The protests I saw at the RNC were pretty much one group. There was a Black Lives Matter group, and then there was a group of communists, basically. And these were the people that were saying, America's never been great. We need to change the system. And those were the two groups. And aside from a few little incidences, flag burning and people stepping on glass and some fights or whatever, it was relatively uneventful for the Republican convention. As I said, it would, in the sense that I thought the protests would be more intense due to a possibility that the battle inside would be more intense. So there's that. And I thought what I would do is a consolidation podcast to just kind of pull all this stuff together, pull my experiences together from the conventions. You heard the Mandy Benz interview on the radio show that kind of gives you a little bit of an inside view of what was done. And that's been pretty much confirmed by a couple of different sources. I think there was a political story, and then somebody else wrote a story for one of the big newspapers about how the Trump people managed to get the establishment to climb into bed with them. I think the establishment was a willing participant from the get-go. And I think that Republican parties, state parties, the national party is doing everything they can do to change the rules so that they can quash any possibility of any more of these Ron Paul or Ted Cruz type grassroots movements in this country. I don't need to belabor that. What happened today is I got this email from the gentleman who sends me funny jokes with all this disjointed rhetoric about Trump. So I thought, I'm going to engage this person in a conversation. I'm going to see just what he knows. And the gist of the conversation was, why do you want to vote for Trump? Because Trump is going to end NAFTA and TPP, and he's going to bring the jobs back that we lost to the United States. This is what he's been saying. And so I said, well, why do you say that? And it comes back more rhetoric. He's just going to do it because he's going to do it. He's the man. He's the leader. He's the one that's going to be able to do this. And so I just kept pressing. And finally, I wrote a list of 9 questions that basically said, well, I'll tell you what my 9 questions were. I have to go on my phone. It'll take a second here to get the thing up. But I had 9 questions for him about, about why he was supporting Trump and why he thought Trump was going to bring companies back, jobs back to the United States. He consistently displaced and refused or was unable to answer my questions. And then he said, well, why don't you go to Google? You asked too many questions. So I finally said, here's my 9 questions. Because he's saying all these companies have lost jobs due to NAFTA and TPP, which has hardly gone into effect, so you can't really say that TPP has caused any job losses. What companies, what jobs, and more importantly, what do the people who have been replaced in those jobs do? Is this a problem? How is it a problem? What specific proposed Trump policy addresses said problem? How is he going to address that in Congress? You know, you have, for example, senators and congressmen who have ratified or resolved to accept treaties that have been negotiated. So you'd have to reverse all that with new legislation. You can't just, Congress is not going to say, hey, by the way, we changed our vote. You have to address it with new legislation, which opens a can of worms. 8, what is the difference between NAFTA and TPP? And he kept talking about people brought in from South America to do jobs at Disneyland. And I said, what's the difference between NAFTA, TPP, and what you're talking about, which is really an H-1B issue, which is the H-1B visa issue slash immigration, because the people that are being brought in to work for Disney are not illegal immigrants. They're probably people on work visas. Okay. Then I said, do you own stock in companies cited for that you cited and or use their products? His response to me was this. I feel perfectly well with Donald J. Trump given the choices. I think he is similar, not the same as Lincoln, but close in many respects, a long shot, they say, willing to buck the system, a man for the people. Remember, it is the leader that often makes the congregation. He will bring back all the jobs as he will end NAFTA. Yes, he will get Congress to go along with him. That will bring back the jobs. Now you tell me why and don't give me a bunch of radio talk. BS. TPP and NAFTA are not dead air. I said they were talking about that as dead air because it's a huge can of worms because you can't just repeal these agreements. You've got to renegotiate them because there'll be huge foreign policy issues if you do. Here's my point, not to relitigate all this, but to point out that we have an economic problem in the United States. It isn't really employment. The problem with employment is that we have a mismatch between skills and what's available for people to do. They now have machines that pick strawberries and pick apples and make hamburgers. Now, they're in the experimental phase. but they are going to become the norm. We now have driverless cars. They're in the experimental phase, but they will become the norm. We have all kinds of autonomous machines. These machines and these software products, these apps, are going to become the norm. What are your children going to do in this new world? What skills are they being taught in school today that will enable them to be productive members of society in this new age that is inevitably coming? And the answer is nothing. They're not being taught how to code. They're not being taught how to use these things. They're using them as users, as consumers. But they're not necessarily being taught how to be productive citizens. Our education system was designed in the 40s and peaked in the 50s. And it was designed to create laborers who would graduate from junior high school and high school. And then skilled laborers, who are usually high school graduates with some vocational training, which usually they became part of a vocational training program from shop class in their junior or senior year, or in my case, radio. And then the college graduates, depending on what schools they went to, the gray flannel-suited middle managers, managers, and ultimately the guys who rose to the top in that environment who would become the CEOs. That was the design of our education system, which served an industrial age. That same education system is struggling to produce people who can compete and work in the present age. Donald Trump is not going to bring back the jobs, because the jobs that he will bring back are already being done by IT and robotics, and will increasingly be done by IT and robotics. Uncle Joe at 70 years old is not going to go back to work at the bucket factory. You know, Sean, who is 45, whose father worked at the GM plant and whose grandfather worked at the GM plant, is not going back to work at the GM plant. He will probably go down to Tennessee or Kentucky or Southern Ohio or some other right-to-work state and work for Volkswagen or BMW building cars down there, or he won't. He'll start a dog walking business or a lawn mowing business, or he'll come and work for an airport fixing airplane engines or something to that effect. And he's going to have a skill that will make him employable. But what I find fascinating, and I see this with Trump supporters specifically, they don't care. They don't want to know how. They don't want to know what the obstacles are. They just want what they want, when they want it, right now. And I don't think you guys realize that once Trump becomes president, and I think that he will be president, I'll be surprised if he doesn't win the presidency. Once he becomes president, you're going to have to defend his policy decisions for 4 years. If Hillary Clinton is the president, then you're going to have to defend your support of a candidate who did not win for the next 4 years. And then the other thing that I keep hearing is, well, do you want Hillary Clinton to be president? And my response to that now, you know what I'm going to start saying to people when they say, do you want a Democrat to win? I'm going to say, you know, a long time ago, Donald Trump said, I'd like to run for president someday, but I would do it as a Republican, because the thing is, with the Republicans, all you have to do is tell them what they want to hear and they'll vote for you. Do you want a Democrat who is a Republican? Because Donald Trump's policies, and even some of the policies of the Republican platform, of all things, are not, they're not free market. They are not capitalistic. They are trade protectionist. They are regulatory, you know, they're regulatory oriented, for lack of a better term. They are larger state solutions. If you listen to Trump carefully, what he's saying is, I'm going to make the trains run on time. I'm going to fix the government. I'm going to make the government work better, which is exactly what Obama said. And by the way, it's exactly what Hillary Clinton has said. So I'm going to start saying, yeah, I do. I want Hillary Clinton to be president, because what's the difference? Do you want a Democrat to be president? My response to that, and I would suggest that people who are confronted with that, is to say, please explain to me the difference and be specific between the Republican and the Democratic Party, leaving out the abortion question. That's the real core issue in the Republican Party and what's left of the libertarians and what's left of what's so-called principled conservatives believe, that the party of today, the Republican Party, in lots of states, and in particular in the United States, the National Party, the GOP, is a bunch of people who have gone along to get along so long. They talk about Reagan, but they don't bear any resemblance to Reagan. They don't have any idea what Donald Trump will do, and they don't care. They just want to win because then they can keep their job. That's the reality of the situation. So if you're supporting Trump, good for you. Go out and work for Trump and good luck. But, you know, if he wins, you're going to find out that it's going to become increasingly difficult that for you to support him, because what you think he's going to do, he can't do, because he is not going to bring back the bucket factory jobs to the United States. It just isn't going to happen. And if he does, if by chance the president, Trump, brings back the bucket factory jobs and the steel jobs and the car making jobs, then when you go to Walmart to buy that clock for $399, it's going to be $22.99. When you go to buy that new truck that you really wanted that was $38.9 last year, in 2019, it's going to be $52.9. When you go to buy the cheap stuff at Walmart, you're going to find out that it's not cheap anymore. And that, if that makes you happy, you know, great. Secondly, if you're a worker and you get your job back, you're not going to get your job back that you had before. You're not going to get it back in $1982 dollars. You know, you're going to get paid less than what you had before, and more than likely it's going to be part-time. Why? Because companies have figured out how to manage their labor forces to get more done with less. And it's going to become increasingly obvious that employees are not as readily needed. I'll give you an example. IBM, and I use this example all the time, IBM used to employ literally hundreds of thousands of people. And they now have closed a lot of their regional offices and downtown offices, or reduced them to the level where they don't have the same footprint in the building or the region that they had before, because they just don't need that many people. So they've been continuing to lay off people because they don't need them, and they have to cut costs because profit margins are thinner and thinner and thinner, because companies are borrowing more and more, because the United States is monetizing more and more debt. These are complex issues that can only be considered complex from either left or right, and the right has no solutions. They don't understand what the problem is. Either they pull out the Reagan solutions from 1980, which aren't going to work because we don't have high inflation. We don't have high interest rates. We have a completely different situation. We have a deflationary situation in the world. So the solutions that worked when you were 20 are not going to work today when you're 60. And people don't understand that, because he's just saying what they think that what he thinks that they want to hear, and apparently they do. And, you know, for the Democrats, for their part, they're doing the same thing, a chicken in every pot. We're going to give everybody, you know, free college, and we're going to take care of everybody, cradle to grave health care, and we're going to fix this, and we're going to provide all these things, and we're going to have a wonderful world, and we're going to do all these things. And people just aren't thinking deep enough on the issues, and they don't know where to go to get the information. So it's all about conspiracy theory, you know. It's all about fairy tales that make them feel good about themselves, and from an aspirational perspective, make them think that somehow this guy or that guy is going to make things better. And it's not going to end well. What it's going to end with is, it's going to end with the guy that Donald Trump reminds me the most of is Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon, who claimed to be conservative, invented aid to families with dependent children, which is very instrumental in destroying the poor families, and not just black families, but families in Appalachia. You know, he is also responsible for wage and price controls, and he's responsible for taking the United States off the gold standard. These were disastrous policies that have continued to affect the United States, and he was a Republican. And then, of course, he destroyed the trust the American people had in the Republican Party by trying to cover up the Watergate break-in and subsequent issues related to it. And it's tough to hear, but that's Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon gave us Gerry Ford, who gave us Jimmy Carter, and Paul Manafort was Gerry Ford's campaign manager at the convention in 76 that changed the rules to unbind, to make sure the delegates were bound to force through the vote for Gerry Ford instead of Reagan. So if you're a quote-unquote conservative, you should know this history, and you should understand what someone who has an R in front of their name but is a Keynesian means to the United States economically and socially. And if you don't, you should figure it out. You should learn it. And that means you have to read books. And that means you have to stop telling people to Google something when they don't agree with you. And that means you have to stop talking about how you feel. Remember, conservatives were supposed to be the party of people who think. And what does my friend start his email with? I feel. So it's all about emotion and feelings. And that is what's going to happen. Now, could Donald Trump be a great president? Okay, yeah. Is he Abraham Lincoln? No. Everybody knew what Abraham Lincoln was going to do. He was clear about what he was going to do. He was going to end slavery, and that is what broke the Union apart. And he, you know, that was the disastrous effect of the Abraham Lincoln presidency, the first Republican. And if you looked at it from the person's point of view at the time, that was a terrible war. Was he a great president because he held the Union together? Well, I'll let you decide whether he was a great president because he held the Union together. But I would hardly use Abraham Lincoln as a template to describe Donald Trump. Abraham Lincoln, who started a war. It was the South who started the war. I should be fair about that. But basically, the idea that we couldn't exist as half slave and half free and so forth sparked a war that is still, I think it is the third or second most deadly war in all of history. Even though we've had World War II and World War I and countless other wars since then, you know, Iraq, Vietnam, Korea, and so forth. More Americans were killed in that war than in any other war, I think, in history. Maybe World War II is a close second to World War II, which was almost 100 years later. So in terms of the scale of the time and the population of the time, and the country that America was then, it was a disaster. It was a cataclysm. It was a catastrophe. It was literally the end of the world. So I don't know that I would compare Donald Trump with Abraham Lincoln. So those are my off-the-top-of-my-head thoughts. I do think the Republican Party died in Cleveland. I think the Democratic Party will die in Philadelphia, in the sense that the idea that individual citizens would generate ideas and party platform planks and so forth from the ground up through the primary process, through the individuals working in politics, because of rule changes and because of heavy-handed hardball politics, is gone. And people trying to run grassroots campaigns are going to be hard-pressed in the future to nationalize those campaigns. And I think that's the main reason. The second reason is, there isn't a single candidate of any measure in the Republican Party who really is for capitalism and for free markets and for liberty and for freedom. They are all, in one way, shape, or form, for the expansion of control by the state. So that means more police. That means more state control. That means more money for government. And Richard Nixon, too, was going to make the government run more efficiently. This is the oldest canard in politics. I'm going to make things work better without really changing it, because it's all about me. And as I've said many, many times in these podcasts, the presidency is a powerful political position, but the government itself, the behemoth that is the bureaucracy, is enormously powerful, even though it's essentially benign. It does whatever it does. But the president pushes a button and nothing happens. The real power is in Congress. And there's no principled conservatives in Congress except for a few wingnuts, you know, on both sides, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Ted Cruz, you know, or Jeff Sessions or whatever, you name the guy. And so we're in uncharted waters. We're in a new territory. We're at the end of an era, and the era is changing. And what comes out of this, I can't tell you. I don't know. But it's not, could it be good? I guess it could be good. But I'm not particularly optimistic about it. It's one of the reasons I've kind of pulled away from politics and more interested in things like the air show. because it's about people trying to do new stuff and thinking about new ways to do things and being creative with building and creating and manufacturing and flying. Or in the case of Sturgis, it's just people having fun. Or in the case of Burning Man, which I hope to go to, I haven't seen my tickets come through, but we'll see. It's about building a new society for the kinds of things that they think are a good idea. So, you know, I'm sad about it more than anything. And I'm sad for both sides. I'm sad for the Bernie Sanders people, and I'm also sad for the Republicans especially, because I think they really think they're doing good. And I think they really think that they've got something, but they don't. And I don't think they understand that they don't. I think they've climbed on board with a guy because they wanted to win. And they didn't want to be seen as the guy who was making the noise back home on TV. And they didn't want to be seen as troublemakers. These were national committee men and women and party leaders and important people. And the same thing will happen with the Democrats, because when these hardball I talked about pressure on delegates early in the primary season, that when these delegates finally get to where they're going, there's going to be enormous pressure on them. And I had no idea how ugly it would get. And people say, well, why are you raining on the parade? Why are you being so negative? You know, aren't you optimistic about the future? You know, I'm not optimistic about this election. I'm optimistic about the things that I see in technology that are going to force a different future for us. And I think really the only question is, does it happen in 50 years or does it happen next year? That's really the key question. And Peter Thiel kind of touched on that. And I'm sure that there will be a Democrat at their convention that will briefly touch on that, probably in a negative way. But, you know, we have some tremendous tools, really powerful tools. The tools we have in our hand, our phones are incredibly powerful and capable. I was remarking to somebody tonight that GPS on the phone is probably the most incredible invention since fire in terms of making people's lives simpler and preventing people from getting confused on the road, because you just follow the directions and it takes you to where you need to go, where you chose to go. So it's stuff like that, this stuff is in its infancy. Think back to 1928. You know, they invented television in the 20s in this country. But because of the Depression, we didn't get it until the 40s and 50s. And really, it didn't come on board until the 50s. There was a whole bunch of stuff that happened. And one could argue that because of the terrible economic policies, partially of the 1930s, we ended up in a conflagration, a world war that was, you know, again, a catastrophe. So leadership, if they do the wrong things, even if they're for the right reasons, can have tremendously negative consequences for all of us. And I just hope we all think about this. And for people that say, well, what's our choice? We don't have a choice. Well, the point here is that when you finally get to the presidential election and you're going to push a button for guy A or guy B, if you've waited that long to get involved, then go ahead and vote for guy A or guy B, because it doesn't make any difference, because you're not doing anything anyway about it. This is going to take a lot of people getting into politics and breaking the system down and putting in new rules that make sense, not just to break it down, but for a goal. We need a goal. We need to think about where we're going to go, and we need to study these things so we can have informed conversations that are enjoyable and not arguments where we're just trying to get information and where we're not saying, I feel this, so therefore it's true. He's the guy. Stop arguing with me. Google it. That kind of stuff, where people will actually sit and say, well, here's why I think this is going to happen. And then you can say, but what about this? And then they say, but what about this? And you have it, you work it out, and you find the common ground. If we don't figure out how to do that, it's real simple. What's going to happen? I mean, I don't think that you need to go on too long about it. I think it's real simple what's going to happen. What's going to happen is there's going to be a war, because that's ultimately what happens when people act like that. Ultimately, that's going to get transmitted to the larger stage, and there's going to be a big catastrophe, and it's either going to be an economic depression or a war, and it will not be a good experience, and most of us won't survive it. And so if that's what you want, then you just go on yelling and screaming at people, and you go on with your platitudes and your rhetoric, and see what happens. See, I tried to make it positive, but it turned into pretty negative. And I know, if you know, it's a beautiful night. It's a beautiful night here at the air show. I can't wait for tomorrow, and I can't wait to put up some great podcasts about flight from the EAA. Thanks once again to the sponsor of this podcast, Podcast 529, the Bob Davis Podcast, Hydrus Performance, H-Y-D-R-U-S, Hydrus. People say, what's that stuff you drink? It's amazing. It will keep you hydrated. There are so many amazing properties to this product. It's great for weight cuts for wrestlers. It's great for hockey players or football players or anybody doing any kind of competitive sports. SoulCycle, yoga, CrossFit, Yoga Sculpt. It's amazing because you're able to stay hydrated and you're able to practice at your edge. And that's where you grow. And that's what life is all about, is really challenging yourself and taking you to fail, basically. And you see where you can grow. So I believe very strongly in Hydrus, and thanks for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcast. And yes, I am here for Alpha Systems. And the deal is, if you're a pilot and you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, Alpha Systems makes the revolutionary angle of attack indicator. What is it? It's a visual indicator of the amount of lift, the angle of attack of your aircraft, so that when you turn on final approach or maneuver, for instance, crop dusting, it enables you to stay in the zone with enough lift so that you're not going to fall into the ground. That's basically the deal. And it happens. Today was very humid. The air is up and down. There's hundreds of thousands of pilots in this country, private pilots, you know, civilian air aviators. And a lot of them are like, well, I can feel it. I don't need that. If you are here at the EAA, go to Building C, check out the Alpha Systems angle of attack, and just let them demonstrate and let them show you what it does and why, and I think you'll be sold. Alpha Systems. Click on the Alpha Systems banners at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page for more info about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator. They started the AOA revolution in civilian aviation, and their banners at the top of the Bob Davis podcasts page at thebobdavispodcasts.com. Okay? Now, getting here to the EAA air show has meant a lot of people are helping me out. There are some people that have donated. Jack Kelly donated via PayPal. Let's see who else. Bill Mowry, thank you again, as always. Somebody else was in here that gave. Sue Solomon, really appreciate it. Wayne Nelson, and there are others. I'm just checking my email so I can see who else donated. I really appreciate it. I don't care if it's $5 or $1 or what. If you can send me a donation, I really appreciate it, because it goes right to diesel fuel and coffee, basically. It's enabled the trip to the Upper Peninsula, enabled the trip to Cleveland, and now fueling this thing at EAA. So, and then we're off to Sturgis after this. So thanks again for your donations at thebobdavispodcasts.com. Also, thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher.com, and TuneIn.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, the radio show, both on the page at thebobdavispodcast.com as well as on the Patriot at AM 1280 in Minneapolis at 4 p.m. on Sundays. And thank you once again for favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I love Instagram. Posted some great pictures of the air show on Instagram, so check those out. I am The Bob Davis Podcasts at Instagram and at Bob Davis Podcasts on Twitter. So appreciate you guys following and retweeting and all that stuff, and Facebook too. So I think I'm just going to chill out and drink some tea and try to go in, turn in early, because I know I'm going to wake up and there's going to be an amazing air show going on right over my head. Thanks for listening to the podcast 529, the Bob Davis Podcasts, live from EAA, the AirVenture air show at Oshkosh.